Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2023 Home Education Conference held in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
All right, well, you guys, thank you for being here. I really do appreciate it. So the topic was kind of, we went back and forth with LDSHE and they asked us to talk about this topic of building assets. And I had prepared an entire talk about that. But yesterday, as I was speaking with your kids in the morning session, and then they came by several times throughout the day, and last night as I talked to my wife, I decided to change it. So if you want to talk about assets, I'll leave some time at the end. I'll answer some questions on that. What I want to do is I want to talk to you guys about the things I talked to the kids yesterday, okay? And specifically for two reasons. Number one, I think they're topics that are really, really pertinent to this age group where they are right now and for you guys as parents. But number two, I want you to be able to have the language and the ability to speak with them about it, because I think some of them are going to probably be bringing it up to you in some way. So I wanted you to be able to converse with them about that. So we are going to talk about entrepreneurship. So we're going to start by talking about why I'm so passionate about entrepreneurship, and we're going to delve a little bit into, because we're homeschoolers, we're going to delve into the education side, and we can spend quite a bit of time there. And then towards the end, I would like to give you guys some suggestions of how you can help your kids be better entrepreneurs. Not specifically like start this business, but more like principles. We're going to talk about a few things that they can do right now to be better entrepreneurs long term. So if you're okay with that format, that being said, if anybody wants to leave, I would not be offended, because we're not going to be talking about exactly what I was saying. Exactly. I'll be a little offended, but not very offended. but let's get started if you don't mind. So I shared the story yesterday. Michaela Omer, has anybody heard Michaela's story? Okay, Michaela Omer was a four-year-old kid in Austin, Texas. And when she was four, her mom entered her into an entrepreneurship contest. They had one of these kid fairs where you could go, and whoever sold the most at the fair was the one who won the quote-unquote competition. Well, she had been stung by a bee a few weeks before, and she's outside playing, got stung, of course, went in crying. She's just 4 years old. And her mom took care of it. She went out the next day and got stung again by a bee the very next day. So 2 days in a row, she gets stung by a bee. So she's starting to like hate bees. And her mom starts talking to her and telling her about bees and why they're important to the ecosystem. And she actually kind of flips and she starts to be really interested in bees. So as they were getting ready to go to the entrepreneurship competition, they were looking for something they could sell. And she found a recipe for lemonade. It was like an herb-infused lemonade that her grandmother made in an old cookbook. And she decided to replace the sugar with honey because she'd been like doing things with bees. So she made this specialty lemonade, goes to the competition, and wins the whole thing. We were talking about it, so of course she won, right? So she won the competition and got really interested as a four-year-old in selling lemonade, you know, a lemonade stand, essentially. So they started going to a lot of these fairs and farmers markets, and she started selling more of her lemonade. And started doing really, really well with it. And a couple years later, they decided, well, this is doing so well, people love it so much, why don't we bottle it up and sell it? And so they got a bottler and started bottling it up and selling it at different locations. Well, fast forward, so she was four when that all started. When she was nine, Whole Foods called and said, we'd like to start selling your lemonade in all of our Whole Foods locations. So at 9 years old, she signed a licensing agreement to start selling her lemonade at Whole Foods for $11 million. So hugely successful, right? This great story. And I like to share that. I shared it yesterday with your kids because sometimes we get this idea that, well, kids are too young, they're too little, they can't do these things, they're not ready for it. But the reality is that right now at their age is the perfect time for them to be entrepreneurs, to get started. There's no better time. To be honest, like if you and I, if we go out to start a business, there's a lot of risk in that. Like if we leave our job and go to start our own thing, bad things could happen if it goes wrong. But if a kid does it, if they go and they take everything they have and they invest it in their business and it totally completely flops, well, they still have a roof over their heads. They still have food on the table. Their risk is so little, but the learning and the benefit from that is so huge that there's really no reason that they shouldn't be doing businesses right now. So my suggestion is that your kids if possible, should be starting one, two, maybe three businesses before they leave your house. I mean, that's going to be such a benefit to them. So let's talk about a few of those benefits and why I feel that way. You guys, I think some of you may have seen this slide before, as we've talked about before in the past. But if you think about the Industrial Revolution, pre-Industrial Revolution, everybody was an entrepreneur. The entire world was an entrepreneur. If you walked into a village or city, there was a butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, right? Everyone had their own little businesses. Farmers had their business, and they were very family-oriented businesses. So if you were a farmer, your son would probably be a farmer. And then along comes the Industrial Revolution, which was incredible, right? Like we can't put down what the great things that have happened because of the Industrial Revolution. But in some ways, there were some negative effects of that, because when we took people out of those small entrepreneurship homes and put them in the factory, we lost something there. There's no doubt. We lost that connection that families had in many ways. They were no longer able to work side by side every single day and have that same familial benefit. But along came the Industrial Revolution, and instead of needing good entrepreneurs, people that had created new things, we needed to create good workers, right? And there was a lot of things that we did in society to try to create good workers to work in our factories. Well, we've moved along from the steam revolution to the electricity revolution. Most of us lived through what we call the computing revolution. So the third revolution was computing. And this is where, really prior to the computing revolution, people were valued because they were good workers. They were valued because they could work hard and do things. You come into the factory, you put in your time, and that was paid very, very well. As we went into the computing generation, it's interesting, when I was growing up, this idea of going to school, getting an education, going to college and getting some specialty education, some specialty knowledge, was very, very valuable. We needed people that knew things. Knowledge was the currency of the computing revolution. And so when I came out as an engineer, I got paid well because I knew certain things about how materials reacted and how they worked. And so knowledge was very, very valuable in the computing revolution. And learning things and have specialty knowledge is how we paid people. But now we're past the computing revolution, okay, guys? And that's kind of what I want to talk about today is we are into the next industrial revolution, and we call it the intelligence revolution. And we used to be paid for knowledge, and here's the reality of our day. You don't get paid well for knowing something anymore. Why is that? Why don't we pay people for knowing things? Because it's everywhere. Yeah, knowledge is so cheap and so easy and so readily available. Now, knowing what is good knowledge and bad knowledge, maybe that is something that we'll pay people to do in the future. But we're not going to pay you because you know something. It's just so easy. And so we are past the point of getting paid for knowing something. We are into an era where we are going to have to know how to use information and how to use technology in order to be successful. And it's interesting, and I mention this, you guys, because most of our education system is built around the passing on of knowledge. Right? Most of what we do is to help kids know things. We want them to memorize their multiplication tables because they need to know how to do multiplication. They need to know how to, you know historical facts and these. That's kind of how the education system has always been set up. But that's not the education that's going to be useful for our kids as we move into the future. So the revolution of today looks like robotics. It looks like artificial intelligence. It looks like it's a changing over. It's a very, very, and I know AI is like the big, big thing right now. I mean, there's so much talk about it. But how many of you guys have used some of these AI tools? Has anybody used ChatGPT? A couple of you? DALL-E? Anybody used DALL-E yet? Okay, so let me just talk about, it's interesting because I've been talking about these things for about 6 or 7, 8 years. And it used to be that people would be like, they would kind of look at me like, you're crazy. Like, what do you mean AI is going to take over all of these things? Right? And I would oftentimes talk about, hey, AI is going to replace, we're not going to need so many lawyers in the future, right? Because we have AI lawyers. So right now, they estimate that we're graduating 60% too many lawyers every single year. Lawyers that have $200,000 to $300,000 in debt are coming out of law school and they're getting jobs for $30,000 and $40,000, because we don't need low-level lawyers. Because what the AI allows you to do is a lawyer can sit down, type in a case, and the AI will go and do all of the research, all of the fact finding, and come back and tell the lawyer exactly how to prosecute that case, exactly what to do. There's no other. I mean, it can cross-reference every single bit of law that's ever been created because it's all in the system, and the AI is very, very good at finding all that information. So we're not going to need as many lawyers in the future. It's just reality. It's gotten so bad that the lawyers that are coming out of law school are now suing their law schools, because the law schools know that they're graduating too many lawyers, but they're not telling them. They're just giving them this debt to live with for the rest of their life for no reason. Doctors. You guys, I work in the medical industry. I have watched robots do entire medical procedures. I've watched a robot do a total hip replacement. They wheeled the patient in, they pushed a button, the robot opened up, removed the old portion of the hip, put in the new stem, closed it up, everything while the doctor was in the other room watching. I mean, the robot did the entire procedure. And so we are in an era where things are just changing so rapidly. So recently I love these new tools. So this is something, I've been writing a little children's book, and so I need some illustrations. And so this was done in Midjourney. It's an AI tool. The prompt down below, I simply went into Midjourney and typed in, I need a childlike wombat and his animal friends setting up a lemonade stand. It needs to be a cartoon, 4K, and colorful. And I hit enter, and within about 45 seconds, the AI tool created this image for me. Completely new, completely novel. Seriously, never been seen before. That's the AI generating that for me. And I could do the same thing for every page of my book, and I don't need an illustrator because I can generate it right here within AI.
What's that called?
This is Midjourney. DALL-E, D-A-L-L-E is the other one. That's an image generator. So, yes, Grant, yeah. And this was the free version of Midjourney, so it was pretty easy to use. But just for a little bit more impact, so I opened up, this is ChatGPT. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. But let's think of something we can ask ChatGPT to do. So imagine you are an author, a children's author, with a book about Wally the Wombat and his lemonade stand. Create a pitch to a publisher to convince them to publish this book. All right, let's see what it gives us. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Sometimes you have to do a few things. Dear esteemed publisher, I'm delighted to introduce you to the captivating world of Wally the Wombat and his lemonade stand adventure, a heartwarming children's tale. And it tells the kind of the story of Wally the Wombat. And then here's why the Wally Wombat lemonade stand adventure is a must-have addition to any children's bookshelf. Engaging characters, humorous imaginative storytelling, valuable life lessons. Okay? So this is the world that our kids are growing up in. This is the world that they're going to be trying to be engaged with, right? And it's very different, and so sincerely, your name, and this is just a form letter that you could then put out and you could send it to all the publishers. And in fact, if you wanted to, thank you. Please give me a list of publishers that I can send my letter to. And if I want to keep going, I could say, thank you so much. Now tell me someone that I should contact within these publishers, and it will go out and do that for me. Okay? So this is the world that our kids are growing up in, and it's very, very different than what we grew up in, right? This is crazy. The point that I want to make, you guys, is, let me go back to my presentation here. Our kids are growing up in a time that they are, in a very real sense, as we look into the future, we have absolutely no idea what it's going to look like. And if anybody says they know what it's going to look like, they're lying, or they're naive, because we don't. We don't know how jobs are going to change. We don't know what jobs will be jobs. We don't know what our kids will be able to do to create value and to succeed in the world. And because of that, it's difficult to educate, right? Because here we are sitting thinking, okay, college? No college. That's one of the big decisions. Well, what about trade school? Is that going to be a thing? Like, what, you know, what do we do? How do we help prepare these kids for a world that is completely unknown? It really is completely unknown. It's difficult. I mean, and so we know certain things, right? Like we know that driving is going to be probably a thing of the past, or professional drivers. Who's done a Waymo? Has anybody been in a Waymo yet? So down in Arizona and California, Google has set up Waymo. It's an autonomous taxi service, an autonomous Uber. So I did it when I was down in Phoenix one time. W-A-Y-M-O, I think. It's an app. I pulled up my Waymo app. I said, I want to go from this place, just like an Uber. I said, I'm here and I want to go there. And I waited a few minutes, and this van came in, and it had these sensors on it, and it drives up and it parks in front of me, and there's nobody inside. And the door opens, and I sit down inside of the Waymo, and it closes, and it takes me to my location, right? Like, this is something. So we have this right now. These things are all happening around us as we speak. And we could easily just sit and be like, well, it's not happening, it's not going to happen, but it's happening, and it's reality. And so what I want to talk about today is, how do we prepare kids for a future that we don't know when we don't know the future, right? It used to be easy for us, because we knew when I was growing up, if I wanted to have some level of a middle class life, I needed to go to school and get good grades and go to college, and that was the path to a good middle class life. There is no guarantee of that in the future. Absolutely none. And so what I want to talk about, you guys, is how do we prepare these kids? And so let me give you a few suggestions. I'm not going to claim that I know the answers, but these are a couple of the things that I think will help. Number one, we need to stop focusing so much on knowledge and instead focus on helping them know how to take knowledge and solve problems with it. So instead of teaching them, this is the multiplication table, and I'm not talking about simple like teaching them, okay, this is how you solve math problems. I'm talking about real problems, like big problems, things that we don't know the answers to. That's what kids are going to have to know how to do. So we've got to help them be able to solve problems, problem solvers on a daily basis. Number two, we need to teach kids how to learn. And I know this sounds weird, because we kind of think in our minds, well, I am teaching them how to learn. We're doing the things. But as my wife and I have gone through this, it's like, we're not teaching our kids how to learn. We're just teaching them things to learn. We're giving them problems and assignments, and they're learning things, but they're not learning how to learn. And here's why that's really important. Because in the future, when AI comes along and they're doing something, like let's say they go to college and they're on a path and they're learning something, they get out, and then that job is no longer a job anymore, well, they're going to have to pivot really fast. Okay, so and in that pivot, there's going to be a new education process. They're going to have to be able to educate themselves really, really fast. In the future, the person that can educate themselves the fastest and the most efficiently will be the most successful. So being able to see something, I think that's interesting. There's going to be a fruit in that for a little while. I'm going to go educate myself in that, and I can do it. And then when that's gone, I'm going to go to the next thing. So this ability to pivot and educate themselves. And so teaching them how to learn. It seems like the simplest thing, but if you just think in your minds just for a second, what do you explicitly and specifically do on a regular basis to teach your kids how to learn? I will admit that we don't do that much, and we need to be doing more to teach them how to learn. The process of finding information and learning it. Yes?
And the kids just went up and started figuring it all out. They're on the internet. Like, I think in a way, downtime. I agree.
So self-discovery and learning is a lot of real learning. Like, for anybody that's done like real research to try to answer questions there's never been an answer to, most learning that we do is like you're trying to find the right answer. Well, that's not learning. That's just following the path that's already been established. Real learning looks a lot like, I tried this, it didn't work. I tried this, it didn't work. I tried this, it didn't work. And that's how those kids learn that, right? They push a couple buttons. Well, that didn't work. Oh, this one did something. Remember that one, right? So it's that process of trial and error and being free to explore and evaluate those things. Yes?
How do you do that while still protecting them from the evil that's right behind that search?
Yeah, great question. You jump ahead of my presentation. Let's jump into it right now. No, it's perfect. It's perfect right now. So let's talk about devices and let's talk about technology just for a second. It's scary, right? It's scary what's out there and what's at their fingertips all the time. And social media is probably one of the most destructive things that's ever been created in the history of the world in terms of destroying our mental and emotional capacity and our abilities. So here's the reality, though. So I go around and I talk to a lot of kids at homeschool groups and other groups, and oftentimes I'll just do little informal polls. Like, I'll ask them questions. And one of the questions I asked a few years ago was, how many of you guys have devices? And it was a group of homeschoolers, about 100 kids, and about 40% of them said, yeah, we have devices. And that's about the average for a homeschool group. For a non-homeschool group, it's about 75% have devices, you know, when they're youth. But here was the follow-up question. I said, okay, great. But how many of you guys, when you turn 18 and you leave our house, are going to have devices? Guess what the answer to that was? 100%, right? Every single one of them planned to have devices. And so I realized for the first time that we have this decision. We have a choice. We can keep them away from the evil of devices and technology. And that's not a bad thing. Every research study that's ever been done shows that device usage and social media usage versus no device usage and no social media usage is way, way, way better. There's never been a research study that says, oh yeah, using devices is better than not using devices. It just doesn't exist. And so, yeah, that's a great idea. However, they're going to have it. And so the decision we have is, do we let them figure it out on their own, or do we guide them through that process? I compare it to driving a car. Cars are incredibly dangerous. They're very, very dangerous tools that we hand these kids. But not one of us in this room, when our kid turns 16 or 17, would be like, hey, take the keys, good luck. Go out on the freeway and let's, you know, go get me some milk. It's not gonna happen, right? There is a process that we go through that we try to teach them how to use a car the appropriate way. Well, a device is the same thing. It's incredibly dangerous. I would suggest that we are probably losing more kids to device usage than car accidents every year through suicide and other aspects of it. And the data shows that. But it would be crazy of us to just hand it to them when they're 18 and say, good luck, go figure this out, especially when we don't even understand it that well.
That's my point. We are in the same generation as they are as far as gaining access to devices, and in some ways, we're struggling with the same thing using ourselves.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting and it's a partnership.
It really is. So here's the one suggestion. We need to teach them appropriate ways to use the devices, in my opinion. And here's the suggestion. There was a researcher in 2019, and it was right before COVID. And so her research hasn't really been that well out there. But she looked at this and she said, yeah, I realize no device usage is better than device usage, but it's not reality. And so the study that she did is she decided, I'm going to do a study where I show active, productive use of devices versus passive, consumptive use of devices. So a different question. And she did the data, and she ran all the analysis, and she found, interestingly enough, so active use would be like, I'm using it to create videos, I'm using it to create music, I'm talking to people on social media, but I'm interacting with them, I'm actively engaged with them. Passive would be, I'm watching Netflix, I'm just streaming through my Facebook, Instagram feeds, like it's very passive usage. Active, productive use of devices is almost as good as no use of devices. Now, it's not as good, it's not the same, but it's almost as good. So as we have these kids use this technology, dive into these things, in our home, we say, if you're gonna use it for production, as you have free rein in that. So use it for production, create videos, create content, run your business, reach out and find manufacturers. Anything you want to do productive, you have a lot more freedom than when you want to consume on the device. So for our younger kids, we don't really let them use the devices to consume unless we're there, we're watching a show together or something. As they get a little bit older, they get more rights to consume. But again, the proper use of a device, the whole reason, you guys, I love being in an LDS conference, we can say this, Heavenly Father's not up there being like, oh no, devices, what do I do, right? He gave us devices specifically with a reason. And here's one of the reasons I think he gave us devices. And it might sound weird to you, and this is just my opinion, so it's not doctrine or anything like that. I believe strongly that Heavenly Father knows that this generation of kids needs their parents home with them more than any other generation in the history of the world. needs father's home especially and mother's home with them. And so what he's given us is tools and capabilities to bring fathers home. Through entrepreneurship and the tools on these devices, we have the opportunity to bring our fathers home and be with their families more often. I strongly believe that's one of the biggest reasons we have this technology. But we have to know how to use it for the production and not the consumption. Does that help with that question?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for asking that. So let's back up just a little bit. Back to this. So we were talking about the things we need our kids to know. So we talked about knowing how to learn. And I've lost my train of thought, so give me just a second so I can talk about the next one. So problem solving. We talked about problem solving. The last one kind of ties into what we just talked about. Our kids need to know how to produce and create. Produce and create. And so we need to be giving them time to go into these endeavors where they are the creator and not the consumer. All of, you know, reading books and reading even the best classics in the world is still a consumptive activity. Now, it's a good consumptive activity. It's not the same as playing video games, but it's still consumption. And we find that in the research, we find that production is a really, really powerful tool to help these kids mentally and emotionally prepare for the world and be strong. And sometimes we don't give them enough productive time, enough productive activities. And so my recommendation is in your homeschooling, if you can set some of the consumption aside, some of the even the good consumption, to give way for more production, it's going to be very, very valuable to them emotionally, mentally, and there's no better way to prepare them for what's coming in the future, because if they can produce and create, then they're going to have more opportunities than those who can't. Questions or comments about what we've talked about so far? Yes. Yes. So play is productive for the younger kids, right? Getting out and playing and doing things, being active, sports, that kind of stuff. Creating. So production to me is anytime something comes out of us into the world, that is production. So if I'm going to create music, if I'm going to create art, if I'm going to create video games, if I'm going to create video content, that's all my imagination having to do something. And here's the key to production. It's not production until it comes out. So if you have a kid that just sits and he's like, I'm producing, and it's just all in his mind, not the same as when it comes out into the world, right? It has to come out.
That's what I wanted to clarify. When you're talking production, you're meaning technological production.
Not necessarily. It could be any production. It could be going out and doing woodworking. It could be any aspect of producing something, creating something from ourselves.
I read a quote once that to intake without giving anything is like, it's like as if you didn't intake it at all because you're not sharing it. So yeah, I believe our kids can share in all different ways of what they're intaking.
Yes, I love that.
Do you have any insight on what the research then about what we need to do with that produced content? Like, are we allowed to throw it away?
No, it's asking for a friend. So the research demonstrates that production is, getting it out there is the important part. So here's what I suggest. Let them get it out, and then we have to praise it, but here's the key to our praise, and I have a whole topic where I love my production consumption. I could talk about this all day long. So when we praise it, you have to be extremely, extremely careful not to praise the final product. So don't praise the beautiful artwork, right? In the praise that we do when they produce, you have to praise the effort. You have to praise the process. And here's the interesting thing. If you want to stop having to save everything, if you will make it a regular habit to praise the process, they're going to stop caring quite so much about what happens with the product. Because they're like, oh, I worked so hard, Mom. Look at what I did. I spent 5 hours. And you're like, that's amazing. You worked so hard. Tell me about the process that went through to do that. And they talk about that. And you're like, man, I can't wait to see what you do next. Like, what this process takes you to next. And then they're kind of like, okay, that one's behind me. Now let's get on to the next production. Some kids are some kids struggle and they're going to be holding on to those things. I have a 6-year-old who produces a lot and he wants to keep it all. And he really struggles. It's funny because we recycle the stuff that he does, but he's in charge of taking out the recycling. And so he'll be the one, he'll be digging through and he'll be like, Mom, you threw on my paper. Yeah, it's so funny. Yes.
Products, and I say, let's take a picture of that so we can always have it, and then we'll dispose of it.
Yes. Yeah, that's Elizabeth's.
It's better so they can see the picture and remember, oh, that's why I created this. And
yeah, that's awesome. That's a great idea. It's an easy way to digitize those things. Yes?
How does that tie in with your celebration of failure? Like, it feels like that could tie in when you talk about the product and product.
It absolutely does. No, it absolutely does. So as we, so let's jump into failure. Let's just talk about that. We'll do failure a little bit later. No, but let me touch on it when we talk about failure in just a couple minutes. Yeah, right back here.
My daughter, like her creative outlet was art, and yeah. She's an art major now, illustration, and you just like slashed her future. What, how do you reconcile that? You know, like,
yeah.
They can do it all digitally. Like, what's the point?
Okay, so the point is the creation creates emotional, mental strength to be able to create things and have that and know the process of knowing how to learn and produce something out of that. And you're right. There may come a time where we are definitely not going to need as many artists as we used to, right? And so your daughter knows how to create, knows how to be creative. She's going to have to pivot. She's going to have to pivot and say, now what can I do with these creative juices and what can I do? And she might have to learn something completely different. But here's the point. We can't be like, well, it's not going to happen. She's not going to lose her, you know. It is. It's going to happen. It's going to be replaced. So knowing how to create and produce is really, really valuable because now they can pivot and produce and create somewhere else. So I can't tell you I can't tell you it's not going to happen, but what I can say is she's in a great position to be able to pivot, better so than the person that all they've ever learned is how to type information into a spreadsheet, because they don't know how to create and produce and pivot as easily. It's going to be harder for them to make that pivot than someone knows how to produce and create. Yeah. Was there another hand? Yes.
Quick question. So in my head, I'm thinking, there's a way we could do like a homeschooling through family history, right? So if I say, well, a lot of people want to learn about this, and so she does some research and the production, you can see the age of like the board or something like that. But I'm wondering, if you're there, the premise of this ChatGPT is that all the knowledge that we know about, right?
Yep.
There's lots of knowledge we still don't know about. So there's still researching, learning to research is still a thing, I would think, to help add to that knowledge that's going to be in the
question. Yeah, I think there will be a space for some researchers to be doing things, absolutely. We won't need as many because if you know the right question to ask ChatGPT and the AI, whether it's a ChatGPT or another one, if you know the right question and you know where to look, then it'll do a really good job of going and finding it for you, right? So, but knowing how to use it to do that is awesome. What's that?
I said it'll give you the answer the internet wants you to see.
Well,
whether it's the right answer or not.
So that, yeah, so there is the checking, right? So we, and for a long time, we're gonna have to do that. And there's a very large concern about AI. It's trained on all this information. It's trained on all the information, and a lot of that information is not right. So there's concern with that. So there will be spaces for that. But the point I'm trying to make is, yes, there's going to be spaces for these individual pockets. I'm not saying there shouldn't be any lawyers and don't have your kids be lawyers. I'm just saying if all of us decide our kids should be lawyers, then some of our kids are gonna lose. Because we're not going to need them all to be lawyers. We're still going to need doctors, but not all of our kids can be doctors because we just won't need that many. Yes?
In the past, right, following your passion wasn't necessarily the best choice because my passion is music, right? But as a mom, I wouldn't want that as a part of my career. Because all of the things that you're offering me, when I put my kids to bed, someday after me, when I want to spend time with them. And so it was always the right choice that you follow your passion. That is changing. Now is the time where you can follow your passion because with all of these opportunities, we can make it work in our lives. And I think that's what you are bringing up is this beautiful marriage of our kids will thrive if they are doing what they love. And nowadays, they can find a way to monetize it with all of these different resources. And so if they want to do something, they are no longer limited the way that we were limited in the past by a 9-to-5 job. The world has opened up. You can follow your passion and find a way to make that applicable and monetize it in a way that's good for your time. On your timetable with all of you.
Yeah. And I would take it one step further. I think what I'm saying is that they're going to have to do that, that there won't be another option. I'm going as far as to say that. And the passion piece, I hope that every kid finds something that they're truly passionate about. But whether they do or not, the reality is that they're going to have to create something. And they're going to have to provide value somewhere. And so, yeah, if they find that passion and they can turn that into something, that's amazing. If they don't, they're going to have to create something and turn that into something anyway. So the point is I just don't feel like there are going to be as many opportunities for these kids. And it might not happen like right now in your kids. Like, here's the thing. Your kids could probably very much benefit from going to college and going out and getting a job for the next 10, 15 years. But it's the 20 years that I'm worried about, right? They're going to have to pivot at some point, and they're going to have to pivot again. Right now, and on the average, people are changing jobs every 3 to 4 years, and they're changing careers every 7 years, meaning they're going from accountant to engineer every 7 years. That's the average for the United States. Our kids are going to be changing careers every 3 to 4 years, 2 to 3 years. You know, it's going to keep getting shorter because things are going to just keep changing so rapidly and so fast. And that's why they have to be able to know how to learn.
Could you give an example of a problem that you could give to a 14-year-old and say, okay, here's your problem, solve it?
Yeah. I mean, it can be stuff close. It can be stuff close to you that you can. So I like to... I've started to put together some problems for my 11-year-old son because he loves doing that, but he gets really upset when he can't figure it out, and I kind of like pushing him into that. Like, I wanted to have more of that. And so I'm taking some of the problems of the past and giving them to him. Like, oh, like, we don't have the ability, like, how can we mobilize a group to do something? Or how do wheels work, and how could you use that to solve a problem of moving something up a hill? And sometimes we'll go very local. We could be very much, hey, we've got all this stuff in the barn that needs to be moved somewhere else. What's the easiest, quickest way to do that? You can't just go do it manually. You got to figure out another way. Like, it can be very much hands-on types of problem solving, or it can be big and abstract. I mean, if you want to really challenge them, say, hey, look at the problem we're having with all this waste. You know, recycling is not recycling is not a profitable venture, so we're not recycling anymore as a country. What could we do with some of this waste, you know, and help me solve this problem on a local level? So there's those types of problems as well. Yes.
Looking for problems, and so he'll, like, some of the problems he's found is when he goes to a barbecue and he has his plate, it's always a pain to have enough hands to get your cup. Mm-hmm. So he came up with a device that he can wear when he goes to a barbecue so that he can put his cup on his little thing and have his hands free.
Love it.
So, I mean, I think that, not that that's going to change the world, but the idea of moving in that direction, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe somewhere along the line he'll find something that, you know, is useful to others. But I think it's the process of problem solving and recognizing, I see this problem, it's a problem to me, I'm going to see if I can figure out a way to make it a little easier.
Pretty sure I
want
to meet your kids.
And that ties in so well with like the idea of an entrepreneur. What is an entrepreneur? It's someone who sees opportunity everywhere, right? So in my house, I get so frustrated because my kids, this is just our problem, probably. You guys don't have this problem. Peanut butter jars and knives. So they take the peanut butter, they do the peanut butter thing, and they stick it back in, and it's all up the handle, and I'm like, duh! Somebody needs to solve the problem of why can't we have... So the lid needs to have a little place for the knife, and et cetera. So those are the types of things that they can see. And an entrepreneur sees opportunity everywhere. When we do our... we have a guidebook out here to show kids how to kind of get started on their business, and we have them start out. The very first thing we do is look for problems. So they come up with like 60 problems that they see around them. We have some questions to guide them through that. And then they go talk to 5 people and ask them the same questions. By the time they've done, they have 300 different problems that they need to solve that are around them. And then we do that because it opens people's eyes, right? And it gives them opportunity to see these opportunities all around them of things that they can solve and they can do. And if you do it that way, they'll start coming to you saying, this is a problem I want to solve, and you are just the support and the cheer. So, yes?
A lot of it is the confidence to step into that and say, hey, I have this idea, and then have the confidence to move forward.
Yes. Yep.
And solving things that gives them the confidence to say, hey, I can do this. Hey, this is possible. where a lot of kids would just sit back and
absolutely.
Oh, I have a great idea, but
then they just sit there and be entrepreneurs the rest of their life. Yes.
I have a dad who is an entrepreneur as well, but I feel like the thing that holds me back and the thing that holds my kids back a lot is fear of failure. And so we've tried to flip it to make failure a good thing. Like, what did you learn from failure instead of, like, how do we not fail again?
Yeah. Perfect segue. So let's thank you very much. I'll pay you later. So a couple of principles, you guys. We have about 10 minutes left. I always run out of time because I talk too much and I like to answer questions. But failure. Here's the reality. Your kids need to be failing more. Your kids are not failing enough. None of our kids are failing enough. My kids aren't failing enough. And we probably individually are not failing enough. Failure is the most incredible, powerful teaching tool that we have in our toolbox, and yet we avoid it like the plague because it hurts and it's scary, and society tells us that it's bad. And just think about it just for a second. When is the last time you personally have put your heart and soul into something, tried your very, very best, and it just didn't go well? It might have happened recently for some of you, but I'm guessing that for a lot of us, it's been a little while since that happened. Because most of us are relatively successful in our lives. But we need, what that means is when we're not having regular failures, it means we're not putting ourselves in positions that failure is a possibility. We're not stretching, we're not pushing. Our kids live in a very safe world. Despite what the news will tell you, we live in a world that's probably as safe as any world has ever been. Right, our kids and us as individuals will live longer than anybody else has ever lived. If we break ourselves, we're fixed very quickly. I grew up in an era where helmets were like, we didn't even know what a helmet was, right? And now kids wear helmets everywhere. So they're in a very safe environment, but we need to find ways for them to fail more. Failure is a powerful, powerful teaching tool. And so here's one suggestion, something that we've enacted in our family. Right? If you want your kids to fail more, you need to make your family culture a culture that accepts successful failures. Okay? Successful failure looks like a failure where they put their heart and soul into it. It didn't work out, but they then learn from it and pick themselves up and keep going. That's a successful failure. Here's what we've done that's been really helpful for us. On our Sunday night dinners, we used to always sit down and talk about the wins and what went well that week. Well, we added a few years, just one simple question. We said, what did you do this week that was a total failure? And the kids will say some things, or dad will mention something. And then the only thing we praise or applaud in the whole evening is the failures. So someone says, I failed in this, and we cheer and we clap and we applaud. We say, nice job, nice failure. What did you learn from it? What can you do next? What are you going to do for the next step? We make that failure piece an acceptable and good portion of our family culture. Now remember, we praise the effort. We praise the effort that went into it that led to the failure. And here's the key to this. You can't pray, you don't clap for failure to try. Oh, Dad, I was supposed to do this and I didn't. Well, that's not the failure we clap for. Or we don't clap for moral failure either. Dad, I was out doing this and totally sinned. That's not the type of failure. It's just the failures. We clap for the failures where you tried, you put your heart and soul into it, it didn't work out the way you wanted it to, and then you move on. So that's the type of failure we want to look for. And going back to the question that Matt asked earlier, yeah, when they produce things, when they're doing regular production, man, it is awesome. There are so many opportunities for failure. If they're just consuming, they're never going to fail. It's really hard to fail at clicking next movie on Netflix. That's a pretty, like, most of us don't fail in that, right? But failure is very, very real when you're out trying to produce something, create something new. And so we praise the process. We have a culture that is very, now, here's the key to this, you guys. If you start this, your kids are not going to want to share their failures. They're going to be like, what do you mean? Like, fail, what do you mean? And so if you want it to really work for a few months, it's got to start with you. It's got to be your stuff first. So my kids love to hear about my failures. They just love it. They can't wait for Sunday night to hear what Dad failed in this week. And it got to a point where I started creating new stories, and I call them the stories about a boy named Nephi that's totally not me. Now, they know it's me, but it's totally not me, just for fun, just to make it fun. And I tell these stories of absolute failures and dumb things that I've done, and they love it. And they know that Dad tries and he fails and he does things. But at the same time, they watch and they're like, Dad, you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro last year. Awesome job. Like, like there was this big success. But Dad, you did this and it wasn't such a great success. And they see those ups and those downs. And so they recognize that I'm able to do great things only because I fail in a lot of things. And it becomes a culture where it's acceptable and okay. Now, I wish I could tell you that all my kids love failure and they're just awesome about it. They're not. They struggle with it still. But we do have a culture where they feel safe being able to say, I failed. I tried really hard and it didn't work. Your kids need to fail more. It'll make them better entrepreneurs. It'll make them better people. And it'll better prepare them for a world. If they're not willing to fail in the future world where we don't know what it's going to look like, it's going to be really, really tough for them. So they, like you said, they need that fortitude to know that I can try this thing, and if it doesn't work out, that's okay. It's just another way that's not going to work. I can pivot and move to the next thing. Are we okay with that? Questions about failure?
How do you feel about destroying your self-esteem? I have a kid who already has very low self-esteem, and I have no idea how to help him lose what little he does have.
Yeah. I think the key, like we were just talking about, to me the key, and it might not be the same for your son, if you will praise the process that he went for so that he knows that he succeeded in the effort, but he failed in the outcome, it's going to be easier because he will gain self-esteem in being praised for the process and the effort that he put into it. Because then he'll know, if I put effort into something, I get praise, there's a good benefit in return for that. The outcome doesn't matter as much. Then he's going to be more willing to do that. He's going to be more willing to push into that. So focus on, it's not like, oh my gosh, you failed. You're so awful. You didn't do it. It's, wow, that's an awesome failure. Man, you tried so hard. Look at all these things you did. What did you learn from that? What did you take away from that? That's amazing. Look how far you've come. Like, it becomes this very, very positive lifting thing. And it allows him to step into new things that he wouldn't otherwise do, which always builds confidence. Great question. Other questions?
President Lincoln was a great example of failure. And we were listening to a book as we drove into Gettysburg on Tuesday called Go for the No, which is all about, like,
yeah,
the more no's you get, the more rejection, the more successful those people are. And it was right at the part talking about Lincoln and all of his failures as we drove in, and there was a billboard of Lincoln on the side. My kids were like, how did that happen? So
that's awesome.
He's such a great,
great example. Yeah, here we are in Gettysburg, and he failed at so many things prior to having some success.
He had depression.
Right.
Yeah.
You guys, I wish we had a lot more time.
Start over.
Let's go again. Let's run it back. Did you have a comment or question?
Well, I was just gonna say it's interesting when you're talking about failures. Like when you interview for a job, almost always they'll ask you to be like, can you share a recent failure and what you did? Like, that's a common interview question when you go interview for a job. And I was interviewing some people, and I was amazed, like, how many kids, like, they don't know how to answer that question and talk about their failures. And, like, one girl was, like, almost in tears thinking that, like, she had to be perfect.
Yeah.
And she couldn't fail. And we were like, no, like, failure is okay. You know, we just wanted, like, the second part of that question is, like, what did you do next? Like, it was such, like, that's kind of, like, the idea of the question is to see how you pick yourself up.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, even just, like, having that, being able to discuss it, like, what a tool to even just interview for step one.
Yeah. Thank you. You guys, thank you so much for your time. I hope you walk out of here not feeling like your kids are doomed. They're not. There is so much opportunity. There's more opportunity for them than there has ever been in the world. I hope you walk out of here thinking not, oh, my kid can't be a doctor now, but I hope you're like, wow, he doesn't have to go to 16 years of school. What is he going to do? What world impact are they going to make in the world? They are going to make big, big impacts. But we have to prepare them in a different way. It's not 1993. Don't teach them like it's 1993. Don't teach them the way you were taught. Teach them like it's 2023. Teach them the things that they're going to need for the future. And if you do that, they're going to have huge, huge success.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.